This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Jenny hit Austin.
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It's your old friend Phil Pritchett here. This is the P2 Podcast, recorded every week here at Trinidad World Recording Studios in Fort Worth, my studio here in Fort Worth, Texas. Thanks for joining us. You can subscribe to this podcast, get information about the band, book the band, and buy records, all at phil@philpritchett.com. Email me at phil@philpritchett.com. The website is philpritchett.com. I'm tongue-tied here. Blake Walker is here. Walker, Texas Road Manager.
Hello.
Blake was our road manager for a few years. We've covered the van getting stolen story, rehashed in our last episode. Oh, painfully so.
Painful.
But I feel a good sense of closure now, having talked it out, gone down memory lane with you.
Recounted the horrendous
events of that day, but it's all in the past now. It just sits there as a legend. It's been podcasted, talked about. There it will remain for anyone who wants to listen.
It's just a Steely Dan shirt left. It's all that's left.
That's right. That's still banging around as well. That and the van. The van did come back to life.
Living monument.
We are talking today. I wanted to just mention this kind of at the top of the show. In our, we always try to do a little current news type segment at the top. There's a great book out. You've probably heard of it. Some of you, it is called Outliers by a guy named Malcolm Gladwell. He also wrote a book called Tipping Point. And this book is about success, about people and success. And in our culture, we love to, and I'm going to kind of take this from a music perspective because he talks a lot about musicians in there. It's something I get asked a lot as a performer, producer. Man, is this guy any good? Is this kid a good singer? We don't know. And man, you know, you can't make it anymore. And, you know, there's not going to be another Beatles or anything like that. That's just not how the world is set up. And anyway, it had a lot of interesting debate in the van with Blake and Stolle and Lynch and Stu and Blue over the years. All kinds of talk like that. Gladwell in this Outliers books really takes a close look at the lives of successful people, like Bill Gates, the Beatles. Who are some other people he looked at? Some great lawyers, people like that, and the fortunate circumstances that give them the opportunity to do what they do. But one of the big things he talks about is really the hours of practice people put in. He kind of comes up with this theory of 10,000 hours before you're an expert at doing something. We all like to talk about Mozart being a musical genius. And really, the whole book dispels the idea of a genius, all in all. I mean, after all, Gladwell says we're all born into this world with a brain and an environment, and certain things, we have access to certain things that we take advantage of or don't. And it's not enough to just say, you know, Tiger Woods is a genius. He's just a great golfer. He's a born golfer. Like he, you know, came onto the earth to just go shoot, you know, 64 at Augusta. That there's really a whole lot more to it than that. Of course, the story for anyone familiar with Tiger Woods is, you know, his father and how his father really taught him to play the game at a remarkably young age. And the kid, you know, he took to it like a duck to water. He liked practicing. He liked playing. He was mentally tough. His dad drilled that into him. So by the time he was 10, 11, 12 years old, he'd put in a lot of that time on the range and would really turn into something special. And isn't just some sort of a freak of nature, gift of God talent. He spent some time talking about the Beatles, one of my favorite bands, Walker. and how, you know, the story of the Beatles, for some of y'all maybe not that familiar with it. Of course, we all know they're la-da-da-da-da-da-da on the Ed Sullivan Show. But the Beatles, you know, they got together in the late 50s, Lennon and McCartney in Liverpool. They played, they had a gig in Germany. They went to Hamburg, Germany for on and off for several years, where the band had to play for a German-speaking audience. They were, you know, of course, English guys, people who didn't know their language, didn't know their material, you know, drunken sailors. They played in these strip clubs. And
tough crowd.
They had tough crowd. They had to play like 8 hours a night, every night, for seven nights a week, for months and months and months and months. The bottom line is they got very, very good at being on stage with playing together, playing the audience. People would request show tunes, jazz tunes, for them to act out a scene from some movie or something. Man,
that's crazy.
Well, they just became professional entertainers, and they just had that practice. They had access to that. So by the time, you know, the world spotlight turned on them, oh, I've heard of these guys, the Beatles, on Ed Sullivan Show, or they were playing some shows. Man, they had played together so much. Their act, what set them apart ultimately, was all those hours of practice. Which begs the question: people talk about Britney Spears or the Jonas Brothers or whatever comes down the pike. Everyone's like, man, aren't they just like the Beatles? I mean, you know, they're a phenomenon. They sell tickets, blah 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 blah. What's the real difference? And Gladwell would argue that there, you know, are the bands of today, some of them not as good as the bands of yesteryear. And I think if you do look at the amount of practice put in by the older guys, the Beatles, Duane Allman, the great guitar player for the Allman Brothers, playing slide guitar. The whole point of the book is that, you know, in the old days, talking about the old days, to even have a prayer of being a professional musician or entertainer, you were under no delusions. You couldn't just show up on some show and expect to people to think you're great. I mean, people knew they had to practice. Duane Allman, the Allman Brothers, the Beatles. I mean, you had to work and train and practice and, you know, Mozart. Yeah, I mean, he was great, but he was writing symphonies since he was 5 years old. He wrote symphonies, but Gladwell points out in the book that none of his symphonies were really great when he was 5, 6, 7 years old. They were all variations of other works. And it really wasn't until he'd been writing symphonies for, like, you know, 15 years, till he was about 20, 21, that he wrote his first great work. But it seems like today there is a thing like, hey, man, if you get the right manager and, you know, you appear on this TV show, you can go sell out the Cotton Bowl and rake it in.
Okay, let me say this. This is the hugest argument with my brothers and their buddies and everybody. Everybody sits around and we talk about music. And my limited knowledge of working in the business a little and being around some really talented guys, we'll get into these knockdown, drag-out arguments over American Idol.
Oh, boy.
So you got all these old married guys who, you know, the last time they bought a new album was in college. You know, whatever the cool college band was, they were buying it. Then they get married, they move off, and they slowly, all they listen to is like top 40 radio hits, and American Idol's popular. And so and I call it the machine, and I get angry when I talk about the machine. I mean, these
things
drive me nuts because I worked for Phil for a long time, and I saw all the guys that I believed that were incredibly talented and cutting their teeth and doing their thing. It was a lifestyle. It was forever. There's no way that they're just going to stop doing what they're doing, because
at the core was your belief in the act.
Yeah.
And the integrity of the act. Right.
And so we get into these just horrible arguments because I refuse to watch American Idol, and it drives me nuts. And I know there's some people on there that are great singers.
You're not the target demographic, though, Walker. I think they're going right over your head,
but
aren't they?
They're stealing all my other married folks.
Oh, is that right?
They're taking, like, my brother... my older brother used to be into, you know, the latest music that was out and college bands, and he slowly turned into this American Idol guy. And so I saw him buy the freaking Daughtry album, and it drove me nuts.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I thought to myself, I see like some good albums, and then I see Daughtry on there, and it burned me up. So the first time we sit down, we start talking about it, and he is defending Daughtry to me to the end.
To the death.
And so
I
am livid. I am so upset. And so I've thought about this many times, and we've had this conversation, and you know, we'll get into this argument, like what sets Daughtry apart from another musician? Why is Daughtry a musician? Why is he talented? What makes him, why does he deserve to be in the spotlight?
Worthy of our attention, right.
And so I sit there and tell him, I go, look, Daughtry can sing, that's great. He's good looking, that's great. But that's it. And he's got nothing else. And so they fight back and forth with me. No, he had a band before he was on, you know, American Idol.
Right, but that's not why you're into him. Right.
And I always say, look at Daughtry 20 years from now. Is Daughtry going to be making music, producing, writing? Is he going to be still doing it 20 years from now without the machine, without the marketing, without the TV show, without the spotlight? Or is he going to have to beat his wife and do drugs and go out in L.A. every night to get in the paper?
That's
and this
right.
is what drives me crazy, is you see these guys, and especially Texas, these guys are very talented. A lot of guys driving around playing college towns, they write. And they produce their own stuff, like my buddy Phil here, and it drives me nuts because I see these young people, even on some on Nashville Star and American Idol, and they go through the motions. They're good looking, they got a good voice, and it's handed to them, and it will be taken away just as fast as it's handed one of these days. And if you you stick with them long enough, they're not going to have their fifth, sixth album because the record label is going to drop them. They don't know how to write and produce, and all they're going to be doing is singing in a karaoke bar someday or cover tunes. And it drives me nuts, and we sit here and we argue about these guys, but the real talent are the guys that can write and produce on their own.
Well, these are it is an issue. I mean, it is kind of a I tell guys sometimes there's two hands, and in one hand you maybe have your Slade Cleaves and your Robert Earl Keens and your James McMurtry, your songwriter guys who make a living. And on the other hand, you got, you know, your Keith Urbans and Kenny Chesneys and Toby Keiths. And you can't just say, man, what's the difference between those two hands of people? You're kind of, man, one guys are, you know, they might have some talent stuff, but man, they're in the machine, man. They're being pushed by corporate music America.
Oh yeah.
You know, and these other guys are kind of making it on their own. They might have a booking agent or manager, or a small label or something like that. It all comes down to, as a fan, like you're talking about, Walker, is just that, you know, buying music. Going to a show, listening to someone's 10th song on their album and waiting for the ghost track to get played. You're only going to do that if you believe in the act. And the reason we loved, you know, whoever, you know, the old guys, is, man, you knew that Zeppelin just, you know, didn't care what anybody thought. I mean, yeah, they wanted to sell records and want to be successful, but they recorded in their basement. They did things their way. And, man, the labels... Everybody catered to Led Zeppelin, man. Mm-hmm. The act was king. People catered to Elton John and Neil Young. And, man, they just bent over backwards to make these guys happy. They were the talent. They were the act. And music drove the culture, man. And that has slowly been eroded. I mean, there's other things now kids are into. There's video games or stuff. You know, people stand in line to buy the new Xbox, you know, all night. Or buy the new iPhone. That's who people fight in the street. We used to do that for... you know, Star Wars, the new Zeppelin record came out, people would spend the night in the street. You don't see that anymore.
Pop culture has changed.
And you know, that's something you have to accept as a musician going forward, is, hey, music does not, and Bob Lefsetz, a guy's blog I read a lot, points that out over and over again, and it just cannot be oversaid. Music does not drive the culture. It does not mean it's not important or some people don't like it, but... The people who sit there and just listen to a record and delve into it and allow an hour a day to really let a whole album wash over them are very few. And that's a tough game to play. Kurt South was in here a few episodes. We talked about that. Is the album dead? Do people even have time to listen to a whole album? You and I do, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We make time for it. But it is an interesting question. But back to the Outliers book. Check it out. Malcolm Gladwell. There's a lot of fascinating stuff in there. About the some of the fortunes of men, when you were born, where you were born, as to what kind of opportunities you had.
Yeah.
Bill Gates and all of his guys, they're all the exact same age because, man, they were just in Silicon Valley at a certain time. Mm-hmm. when there was access to some huge computers where those guys could go in for free and learn how to program those computers and mess around. But that all got kind of, that moved on very quickly. But the guys who slipped through that little loophole, man, those were the guys that built the industry.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting stuff. Malcolm Gladwell, start on your 10,000 hours. It's very rare these days you see a guitar player in a bar who is just phenomenally great, and he's 23 years old. It's pretty rare. They're out there, but a lot of guys just go to college and learn a few chords and make a record and say, "Hey, man, how come I'm not on the radio?" You know, and it's a tough question, and it's one of those things where talent still does win out. I went to the Granada Theater to see Derek Trucks, who's a great slide player, probably 30 years old. He was in the Allman Brothers. His uncle was the original drummer for the Allman Brothers. Great slide player. Doesn't sing, doesn't move around, doesn't yell to the crowd, "How y'all doing?" I mean, he just walked out and just played slide guitar played the blues, man.
That's awesome.
And the place was sold out, you know, and you're just like, man, the word on these guys like this gets out. Talent does matter. Trucks, he's not on American Idol. He's not on the radio, but man, the word gets out. This guy's a badass dude. And we were all standing in the rain out there to get in and watch him play for 2 hours. So that was fun for me to see.
That's what drives me nuts is pop culture and this microwave society of I want what I want right now. And the kids these days are raised to where the radio and American Idol and pop culture tells you what talent is. And we've lost the art of really discovering talent and really finding something and going, man, this guy has something really unique and really rare. And instead, we pick up the nearest Britney Spears and we slap on a skirt and tight shirt and now this is talent. And someone writes for him and produces for him and throws him in the spotlight. And now that's talent. And the younger generation buys into it. And that's what music is to them. And that's what really irks me and drives me crazy about the whole scene is that we've lost the beauty of going to a small club and seeing a live show and enjoying it for what it is, you know,
you're absolutely right. My point with Trucks is it still exists and it still does draw. But I think, you know, the old guys, Ahmet Erdogan, who started Atlantic Records, and Herb Alpert, A&M Records, and guys like that who went out and signed, you know, Cat Stevens and The Police, and you know, Ahmet Erdogan signed Zeppelin and Ray Charles, and he was just a music fan. He started a label. He catered to the act. He was not, even though he was a well-known guy, he wasn't a star. I think in the 80s especially, the dawn of MTV, you did have the rise of the super producers, of the super label executives. All of a sudden you're reading in People magazine about Tommy Mottola dating Mariah Carey or something. These guys became the rock stars, so to speak. They were the talent. They were the guys who made the decisions. So they would only sign guys who would play by their rules. They would say, "Look, this is my label. This is how it's done. You're going to do this song." And some of those guys were good at it, but a lot of them weren't. And so what you ended up with was a lot of stuff being ramped, shoved down our throats.
Oh, yeah.
And now we won't get fooled again. You know, we see those billboards of some new singer, like me and Kurt were talking about a while back, and you no longer think, man, that's the new thing, I gotta check that out. You know it's something that's being shoved down your throat and you're out. And, you know, I went and paid money to go see Trucks the other night. He's not on any billboards, so that's a lesson to us all.
I think the 80s showed us how unsuccessful that could be when hair bands became it and were pushed down everyone's throat. And they weren't great musicians, and they didn't have a lot of talent. Somebody else was writing their stuff.
It became more about what you looked like than what you sounded like.
Makeup on and big hair and all this crap. And then Guns N' Roses hits the scene with no makeup, no big hair, and they rock out, and Slash is out there, and it's just raw. Yeah. And it was so popular because they've been fed all this crap for so long.
Motley Crue and
Poison and all this trash with lipstick on and, you know, bad guitar riffs, and then here comes something raw and completely unique and talented, and it blows up, and it did great. And I think you said something interesting when you're talking about Tiger Woods in the book. The interesting thing about that is you know, I can wear all of Tiger Woods's Nike gear. And I can practice every day. I can go to the country club with my old man and I can hit balls all day long.
So why don't you?
And but
even there's money in those master wins.
Hey,
you know what I'm saying?
I did. I tried. I have no coordination. I'm terrible. I'm not coordinated at all. I'm good at PlayStation and telling jokes, and that's it. And so, for me, I knew early on, man, I'm not going to be starting on the golf team or the football team, and there was a lack of talent. No matter how hard I worked, the talent's not going to mix in with that hard work and make me a professional golfer. And no matter how hard we try with these younger groups and how good-looking they are and how good they sing, you can't mesh that with all the practice in the world. If there's no talent there, eventually it will be exposed.
That's right. Well, that has been some Outliers Malcolm Gladwell practice talk news. Pick it up. Outliers Malcolm Gladwell. I'm sure you can get it on Amazon or, it's everywhere, everywhere. I think Oprah even talked about it. I don't know. But being on this podcast, that guy's really going to see his sales jump.
See
a big spike. He's not going to know what hit him.
My mom's going to buy it. It's gonna
coming
be awesome.
Up in our next segment. What were we talking about in segment two?
Was it punt, pass, and kick?
We're going to revisit. That's right. Blake was around, road managing the band during an interesting era. Well, as all men do, we start in the van. Everyone talks about their glory days in high school. Man, I could dunk, man. I could hit a home run. Dude, man, you line me up out there, man. Well, we put this all to rest one spring day in College Station as Phil Pritchard and the full band, then consisting of Jason Stolle on drums, and of course, happy birthday, Ryan Lynch on bass. We also had Jordan Powell, our road manager.
JP.
Blake Walker. Go on. Under the observation of the some of the athletic staff and ground crew.
Craig Potts, ground crew. With Leo.
Blake had some ground crew friends at College Station, so they let us get onto the Aggie practice.
The practice field had the old turf on it. Now it's the indoor. They built the indoor facility over it. Back then it was a turf field on the
turf
side.
Turf field outside in the elements.
Right by the great Kyle Field.
For a Phil Pritchard and the full band punt, pass, and kick contest. We'll fill you in on that when we come back next. Live, recorded live here weekly, Trinidad World Recording in Fort Worth, Texas. Blake Walker, our old road manager and good friend of the full band, is here. How's it going, Walker?
It's wonderful, wonderful.
Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Blake was the, he led a charge to settle all bets a few years back.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of talk in the van, a lot of trash talk between members of the full band.
Oh, yeah.
Recounting of course, none of us knew each other in high school, so you could always brag all you wanted to. Mm. In fact, I have some trouble with that now with Stu and Blue. You know, Stu was a prominent baseball player in high school. So he talks about, you know, switch hitting and, you know, being able to dunk and stuff. And J.W. Marshall, of course, Blue, he played ball. Went on a high school.
Smooth.
SMU.
Great SMU. The
great SMU played full ride scholarship, receiver. So there's some pretty good athletes that we've had in the full band in a while. So I'm a little sheepish about getting any kind of sort of contest with them. But let me tell you what, when Ryan Lynch and Jason Stolle started talking a lot of smack, things became heated. Words were exchanged. So finally Walker says, look, we have a show in College Station. I'll get the grounds crew guy, our friend Craig Potts, who
big
runs...
Big fan.
Big fan of the full band. Yeah. Great supporter of live music in general, really.
Oh, yeah.
We've played Potsapalooza, his great festival down there in the cabin.
Yes.
We love it. Craig, keep it up. Keep that grass growing down there. Keep the music playing.
Oh, yeah, the great Potts.
So Potts gets us in there. So we arrange for the full band to venture on to the sacred turf of Texas A&M football, the practice facility there. And we're going to have a... You know, the old-fashioned, they still do punt, pass, and kick, but I remember when I was a kid, they'd have it like at halftime at the Cowboy game, some kid in like a Redskins helmet, and then a kid in a Dolphins gear, you know, who could throw it the farthest, punt it the farthest, kick the field goal the farthest, whoever wins. So we line it up out there, And man, it was, I don't think I've ever laughed that hard. There were some things on display.
Charlie Brown trying to kick the punt and falling
over. I remember Ryan Lynch, the great Ryan Lynch.
Oh yeah.
Had tremendous difficulty. We had three throws or something. You kicked your best throw.
Three throws, three kicks.
We had
three
like
punts.
The Texas A&M grounds crew and some of the athletic staff, like in the custom made, you know, sweats, yeah. Like with the sunglasses and the hat, like out there with markers. It was a setup deal.
There's some big fans in the Aggie Athletics Network for Phil.
Of course, we all played. We played College Station. Did our a lot over the years. Yeah. Did our live recording down there. So we're out there on the field. So we venture out there. They provide us with nice NCAA regulation footballs, things, a tee, you know, we got a
knee-high socks with maroon stripes.
Yeah, we had sweatbands and the gloves on. And
glory days.
Man, so I can't remember who won everything. I remember I won a couple things. Do you remember who won?
Man, it was just up
Lynch
and down.
Lynch struggled.
Yes, there was some struggling.
I do remember we started like from the 20-yard line for the field goal.
Now, that was actually the best competition out of all. Everything else was very weak.
That's one thing I remember. The field goal was good. Because you could get a running start. Now, I'm just wearing my cowboy boots out there.
Oh, yeah.
Jordan Powell was in his metal-tipped, Doc Martens.
Biker boots, yeah.
Yeah. So I drill a kick from the 20-yard line, like a 30-yard field goal. Little high draw kicked with my Justin Roper. Right through the uprights. Very impressive. Then Powell, he's just a straight-on toe puncher.
Yep.
From way back. The old Mark Moseley style, you know? Just a straight back. But he struggled a bit because, with the toe puncher, if you hit it square, you do get the high rise.
Yeah.
But if you kind of hit it off to the side, you get just that awkward sideways spiral, just kind of like that shank in golf, just kind of a slice where the ball still stands upright but is spinning sideways, you know, spinning like this, like a spiral. So Powell had a couple of those, but man, he drilled a couple through.
Yeah.
And I knew I was in trouble there.
It went neck and neck there for a little while. I remember that.
I think we both hit from 20. We moved back to like 25 yards, and we hit those. And man, then we got back to like 30. It was like a 40-yard kick. Now you could run up and kick it. It wasn't like in a regulation game. And we had a tee, so that needs to be pointed out.
Yes, yeah, there was a tee.
And
there.
I hit from 40 yards.
It was pretty impressive.
And then Powell. I remember distinctly, man. It was the final deal, and he kicked, and he just hit this line drive. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And it just hit right in the middle of the crossbar and bounced back.
Uh-huh.
And that was the end of the punt, pass, and kick. The field goal portion. So I was victorious in the kick. Oh, I remember feeling an immense amount of pressure with all those guys out there watching.
There was a lot of people watching.
These are like scouts that go out and assess talent. Countrywide, statewide.
Oh, yeah.
And here we all are out there, a bunch of musicians.
In jeans and boots on a
jeans
hangover.
Jeans and boots, kind of a little groggy from the night before.
Yeah.
And I remember Stolle, I think, won the pass. He had a good arm.
Yes.
Since I broke my finger in college, I can never quite grip the
ball. Excuses. See, already.
I know.
Already.
See,
it's an old war injury.
If you don't think I brought that out in the van afterwards, I was like, man, if I could have just gripped it, like I could have. And then the punt is difficult. The punt is especially in cowboy
it's
boots.
Tough. Oh,
hard to point the toes.
Everyone was awful at the punt. It was
brutal. I used to be able to punt pretty good, but that's a skill that had left everybody. That was the worst of all.
Yeah, that's
true. The punt, pass, and kick contest. We had a lot of contests in those days.
There was a lot of competition rolling around the van. Some aggression and some. Some pride.
Some card playing.
Oh, yeah. A lot of card playing.
A lot of prideful. Because that was kind of right as the poker craze was really sort of taking hold. And we had a couple of bartenders kind of show us how to play Texas Hold'em. We knew the general rules, but some guys kind of said, hey, man, this is how you need to be thinking and playing.
Oh, we played every night for a long time.
Late. We'd stay up late playing cards. Golly, it about killed me.
Yes, always money, just exchanging hands, always some IOU or a tab.
Balance sheet.
Written on the side of a box that we had merch in.
I know. So what's this Ryan Lynch minus 45 bucks? What is this? Yeah. And, God, those guys went on to then I didn't get into the bigger games, but Lynch and Stolle and y'all start hosting tournaments at your house.
Oh, yeah.
Big time. Y'all had big time poker tournaments.
I had a gigantic poker tournament for my bachelor party, and Troy Johnson and Jordan Powell came, and we had like a 50-man tournament and just all kinds of money going around.
Oh, my.
It just kept getting worse. I think the best story from that weekend, though, isn't even the punt, pass, and kick. It's the fact that I think it was that weekend. It was Missouri versus A&M. Going into overtime.
Oh, we were playing the thing with Ragui that night.
Yes.
Harry's, yeah.
And Potts right. and all them got us yeah. on the field.
For the game.
Oh, it was awesome.
You know, when that came up, I was kind of like, you know, I was excited. I was like, you know, I wasn't prepared for how cool that would be, though. I mean, we at halftime, we'd been in the end zone, up in the annex there. Came down.
The zone.
Then the zone. Then, man, they say, hey, y'all can come on the field for the second half. And me and Lynch, I don't know, who was I with? Someone it wasn't was, there. It was me
it,
and...
It was Kip, right? There was kind of a
Kip
fill-in...
Powell. Ba-
yes.
Yes.
It was Kip and you
Powell.
And Stolly.
That's right.
Because y'all played my house the night before at a little acoustic show in my living room.
Right.
Yeah, invited all the buddies over and had a keg. It was awesome. It's early days. Just parties at that house behind Northgate. We were always in there.
Oh, that was one of the great... Yeah, walk around that house right over there by Northgate.
Yeah.
We played one time in your living room.
And once in the backyard, full band.
Once in the backyard, you had like all the couches out there.
Amps and
very
everything.
Very nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Very
it was
nice.
Fun. It was fun.
Oh, that was fun, man.
Yeah, Kip didn't know what he was in for. He came down, played
Kip
somebody's
Powell.
House, and
yeah.
he's on the field.
I've forgotten about Kip Powell.
Oh, yeah.
So he came on the field.
Uh-huh.
Stolly, of course. I love being... Oh, so I was on the field. We came running out of the tunnel, you know, for the second half. And I look up, and it's just sold out. You can see everyone's face there. It's amazing on the field, and it was exciting.
85,000.
85,000. And I get a call from Jordan Powell, who is in the upper deck. He's like, hey,
he's
man.
On the third deck,
yeah,
like at the top.
He's like, hey, where are you guys? Where are you guys? I'm going, dude, we're on the field. He's like, what? What? He's really pissed. He goes, where? I don't see you anywhere. And I go, man, I'm a... Of course, I can't see him in that sea of faces. I said, man, I am on the Aggie bench. 20-yard line.
You held your arms up. I remember.
I said,
you kinda...
and I was kind of waving. I go, I'm waving, and I hear him just, he's real quiet. All of a sudden, he goes, there you are, you son of a bitch. I heard the dagger just plunge into his chest.
And Jordan and me are both Aggies, you know?
I know.
Jordan would have loved him in there.
Up there in the nosebleeds, and here's Phil, the rock band down there on the field, just kind of running around by the water coolers.
And
everybody's way. And, man, there wasn't anybody down there. It was just, like, the training staff.
It was us.
And us.
We're just sitting there.
It's
R.C. Slocum is literally talking to Dustin Long.
Yeah.
He's sitting there. They're contemplating going for two in overtime.
Yeah.
And Phil and me just, like, kind of listening
I'm kind of overhearing you.
We're just listening in. It was
so
wild.
I just chime in. I go, you got to run left, man. Come on.
It's so funny because Phil – and Lynch and Stolly are the biggest T-SIP Texas football fans. I mean, they had no business.
No
just,
question.
Just all their fans happened to be in Aggieland.
It was sacrilege. Sacrilege for us to even be out there. Although of course, we love our Aggie fans. I was awed by being down there. What a great experience.
That was fun. We lost. We freaking lost.
Yeah, in OT.
In OT against Missouri. That was right before they started getting good and got Chase Daniels. Before that, they had another guy that was pretty
all
good.
Right, all right, all right, all right. Aggie alert. Good grief. What is the show about? Music?
We're going to sit here talking about
Reggie McNeil's draft position or something. We're not going to get into that.
He's
that
with the Toronto Argonauts now, by the way.
Is that right?
Yeah, he's hurting. He's going to be washing cars next.
He's free to wash my car anytime. Well, thank you, Blake. That is some putt, pass, and kick
talk from the
P2 Story Vault.
Love it.
Coming up next, we're going to get into a record that people ask me about a lot. It's kind of a... In a lot of ways, kind of a mysterious era in Phil Pritchett and the Full Band history. We're going to talk about recording in Nashville, a rock record, as you know, the Texas music thing really kind of took off there, 1999. God, you had all these guys coming out of left field. Everybody had a live record from somewhere and was packing someplace. What do? I go to Nashville and make an Elvis Costello album. We'll talk about Suburban Legends when we come back.
Song for all those. Warriors out there.
Thank you. empty hall. I can't seem to attract any kind of human attendance, and that's not too comforting in this covetous tip jar existence. Oh.
Welcome back, fans, Romans, countrymen. Lend me your ears. It's Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast. Recorded weekly at Trinidad World Recording Studios here in Fort Worth. My studio here. My good friend, ex-road manager, ongoing fan, Blake Walker has been here with us today. Thank you, Blake. Special guest in the studio.
Yep.
Well, we're here approaching the vault section. We look at Phil's iPod and... We see tons of vinyl conversions from the old classic records, flown-in CDs, downloads, endless Pritchett demos and stuff I'm always trying out. And one record on there, of course, that we did, we've talked about Phil World and Phil Comes Alive, my first two records. It's only natural we look at my third release at some point. Oh, man, you could do a few segments on this, but... That was Suburban Legends, 1998.
My personal favorite.
Walker, thank you very much.
Love it, absolutely.
Favorite Phil Pritchett record.
Oh, it's great.
Well, the first thing you notice about this is, you know, of course, Phil Comes Alive is a live, ragged, acoustic thing. Phil World, an acoustic deal. Of course, as somebody painfully pointed out to me in Nashville not too long after this, when they were talking about their favorite George Jones songs and the production of George Strait albums, I would just kind of sit there and be quiet, you know. Wasn't a fan. I just didn't know country. Someone finally pointed out, Phil, you don't have a country bone in your body, do you? And I you know, aside from kind of maybe the Willie and Johnny Cash and the stuff I love like that, that's probably true. Real country music, you know, I don't know a whole lot about it. I was raised on the rock and roll, you know, the Beatles, the Stones, Zeppelin, and all that other kind of stuff. And in the 80s when I was a kid, you know, I listened to the Smiths and R.E.M. And U2 and the Police when those bands were around. So that was kind of always my thing. So Suburban Legends, my good friend Wes Cunningham was living in Nashville, and he was making a record for Warner Brothers. Very exciting. And I went up there frequently to hang out with him and watch his sessions and stuff. Very, very exciting. Wes, a really talented songwriter. Fans will know him as the author of Snuff Machine.
Nice. His addiction to smokeless chewing tobacco left on an answering machine.
That was it. Yes. I think he originally did it. That was only a glimpse of his future talent. He wrote some great songs, was signed to Warner Brothers, making a record up there. So I got to know some of these Nashville guys. He was working in a building called, it was the old October Studios there on Church Street. And it was owned by Chris Parker, who was a Whistler's Music Group. And they said, they'd heard some of my stuff. They said, look, man, why don't you come up here with your band and make a record in our studio? And then, you know, I made some studios and home recordings in home studios, garages, that kind of thing. So this was like my first real big studio experience, really, in Nashville at that. You know, there's a lot of that going on. Very exciting. So they said, look, you know, you don't even have to pay to make the record per se. If we'd like to pitch these three songs around, there's a couple songs they're interested in, you know, just to add to their catalog. If you come in here and knock it out in a few days, no problem. So, man, I rented the van from Caps Van Rental. I get my band, which was Doug Holm, who we talked about extensively in this series of podcasts.
Doug,
the great Doug Holm, and Keith Robinson on drums.
Colorado, you made me love you, so I'm putting you on trial for turning me again.
And I figure I need a good utility guy, someone who knows the songs. So I call my old friend, Reed Easterwood, who was Reed's father and my father are actually first cousins. So we're kind of related, kind of grew up around him a little bit.
That sounds very white trashy.
Yeah.
very, very.
Story from that time.
Yeah.
But Reed, it was already known, was a hell of a musician. He'd gone to a Miami music school, a great guitar player, pedal steel player, played everything. So I decided to invite Reed along. And Reed had played with Jack Ingram. That's how I'd seen some of Jack's shows. And Reed was his sideman. And Reed kind of joked and said, man, I was giving this guy Ingram guitar lessons. And next thing I know, he's calling me for gigs. You know, hey, man, you want to play this deal? So I call Reed. Reed says, sure. I thought it was interesting. He goes, man, I got this buddy who has all these really great amplifiers. And I didn't know just a whole lot about amps. I had a couple, you know. But that was sort of voodoo art for me still. But Reed had me come up with a little cash so that he could rent these amps, man. He went and rented like an old Music Man and a Deluxe and a couple of other really cool, pacemaker amp, or is it a peacemaker amp anyway? All these cool little amps. He had his steel, so we load into the car, man, jammed to the gills for Nashville. We're going to stay with my friend Wes and Maddie Adams at their house. So we go into this studio and set up, and man, it was great. We had Shane D. Wilson, who is now a phenomenal engineer up there. But this early on for him was engineering, setting up the mics. I mean, he just had like 20 mics on the drums, you know, and it was a big deal.
Legit.
Legit deal, man. All in the separate rooms, the headphones. We really hadn't done this kind of thing yet. But we were very well rehearsed. We really knew the songs. And the songs were very different. I'm always a hard judge on that. Now, you were from the outside looking in. How did it look to you, the songs? Because, you know, you're going from, like, these drinking songs to something like Lover's Quarrel and Bruising Sheetrock. You know, I mean, it's kind of a leap there. I'm just like, man, these are my new songs, so what, you know? But
I think that's what kind of hooked most of us, that were buying whatever was out at that time. Suburban Legends was so much deeper, and it was, you know, there's catchy hooks and melodies, but the music really was so much deeper than just the redneck kind of dip snuff, drink beer. The stuff that was out there was very, it was Texas country, and it was, you know, that stuff's great, but Suburban Legends was way before its time, in my opinion, and so much deeper than what was sitting out there, especially from a local artist in Dallas, so we all wanted to buy it because of that. But man, there was Empty Rooms and Bruising Sheetrock to this day are two like really powerful songs that I really enjoy that you wrote. And I'm gonna bust your chops and ask you a couple questions about some of those.
I'm already getting embarrassed sitting over here, but you're very kind. Please continue.
But for me, I'm patting Phil on the back right now as we're talking. It's weird.
I know, very strange.
I think Empty Rooms was and Bruising Sheetrock spoke in a different manner because, you know, at that time for me in high school and a lot of guys, you know, you go through this weird, depressed, nice guy finishes last kind of, you know, you're really...
Realization.
You get into these weird... you just get by certain music that really touches you in a weird way that you're just emotional about. And I always felt like those two songs, Bruising Sheetrock and Empty Rooms, really just stand the test of time because they speak volumes and some great lyrics in those songs.
Well, I was really into, you know, as you said, we all started out some semblance of Robert Earl Keen type of country deal. I'd really gotten into Elvis Costello. I mean, I always knew him, but I really got into that sort of new wave, that punk, and just the sound he had on some of his early albums, Armed Forces, My Aim Is True, This Year's Model. Man, just that power pop, just, you know, blasting it out, kind of fast wordplay. Lover's Quarrel was, I think, one of the first ones I wrote for that record. And, yeah, the songs were very different. You know, I was married then. I think there's another thing. I was I was married. I had a young child. We had our first child, had been born. And, so I was kind of grappling with the nice guy finishes last on a whole different level than you were.
Spoke different to me.
Well, I was a little disillusioned with just the beer and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I'd moved on from that a little bit.
Yeah.
Matured a little. And so I was just kind of making the record I thought I needed to make. I did play a CD release show at the old theater downtown in College Station. What was it called?
The third floor cantina.
Dixie Theater.
The Dixie Theater. That was even before me. I didn't even know that. Makes you feel old.
That's right. Yeah, 98. And I'd always send in my records for review to the Austin Chronicle, the local paper there. And they had given a little blurb to Phil World. Hey, this is some nice little country stuff. And I remember it ended with, who is Phil Pritchett or something? Like, hey, it's your morph for this guy. And I sent in Phil Comes Alive. The same guy reviewed it. Raul Hernandez, who's the big editor there, or was at the time. He may still be there. I don't know. And he said, man, this Pritchett, Phil Comes Alive is great. It's, so it felt good to get a little press in Austin and a lot of bands down there. So I sent in Suburban Legends, and we played we had the review come out on that Thursday, and that Thursday night we were playing in College Station. And I get a call at 8 in the morning from Keith, our drummer, saying, hey man, there's a review of Suburban Legends in the Chronicle, and it's not good.
Oh.
And I go, what? You know, and so I rush out there and get it. And there's a huge picture of the record, me sitting in that chair. Suburban Legends next to it, like half a star out of 5.
Ouch. What's this guy's email? We can email him immediately.
Yeah, it was. He was Raul Hernandez.
Jerk. Crushed my dreams.
Hey, it's the free press.
Raul.
It's the free press. But let me tell you what, man. It was you probably still find it online somewhere. The Austin Chronicle Suburban Legends Review. It's pretty priceless.
Half a star.
So, come on, man, Raul. He just goes off, man. Just, man, I guess he liked the old country kind of thing I was doing. Anyway, he just says this album is nauseating. It's just contrived and gutless and whatever. It was harsh, man.
Wow.
Really harsh. Really, really hard to take. So I had to gear up and go play some show in College Station.
Show.
So we go out
there.
Are you
ready to rock?
Yeah. So we go out there. We play that theater out there, which it was one of these things like that place. It opens for like 5 months and it's closed for a year.
Yeah, there's a lot of those.
So we had like very minor turnout, maybe had like 50 people kind of come out. Yeah, we played. And on the way back, on the 290, or no, on 21, before we get to 290 on the way back to Austin, we have a flat tire in the Suburban. And we kind of skid off the road into like this muddy ditch. So we're trying to move the car back. We're kind of both stuck in the mud and kind of on the ground. So we have to call AAA, get the tow truck out there to pull us out and put the tire on. So Keith and Doug just fall asleep in the back of the Suburban. Tell me when the tow truck gets here. It's 3:30 in the morning.
Sounds like.
And man, I was covered. I was covered in mud. I'd been out there crawling under the trying to get. I'm covered in mud. I'm covered in oil. And I sit up on the hood of the Suburban. And it was a pretty night. I remember the moon was out. And I was just laying on the hood. But man, it'd been a hard day. I was like, man, I made this record that I liked, and man, I'd already had this review, and now I'm just sitting in the mud ditch, just wondering, man, what am I trying to do with my life? Why do I care? Why don't I just quit and just go do something else? You know, so I remember that being a very pivotal moment, to say the least. Just sitting alone out there with the band asleep in the car, just waiting for the tow truck. I was like, but
would have been nice if Raul would have showed up driving the tow truck.
That would have made you feel better.
You know,
so. I got carved up on that, but the record over the years, I think, has really endured. I always think it's funny that Bruising Sheetrock has really emerged as one of the, because that wasn't going to be on there. And Reed, a very serious, eclectic guy, I'd send him that song on a demo for him to learn some parts on, and he did that banjo part.
Oh, beautiful, and said, beautiful banjo.
He said, man, I got a great banjo part for that song. And I kind of went, oh, man, I don't know. I mean, I don't even know if that one's going to be on there. It's kind of too depressing stuff. And, man, that was the only song on the whole album. He just goes, no, no, no. He goes, that has to be on there.
Oh.
He said, I go, man, but it's different and weird and stuff. He goes, man, that's the stuff that's going to make you great.
He was so
I always remembered him saying that. And so we went in there. We did it in one take. It was kind of an afterthought. We were running out of recording time. So I went in there with the guitar, and he just sat across from me with the banjo. Well, we cut the whole thing live, and I sang it one time, and that was it. That's the version you hear on the album. And it was a really good sounding record.
Yeah.
it still sounds really good, I think.
The banjo on that song is phenomenal.
Yeah.
I've always begged you to play the banjo, get someone on stage to play the banjo when you play, because it makes it so much sadder. It's so perfect.
Yeah, it is a sad, mournful tone. And it's funny that rowdy guys in bars really want to hear that song.
We loved it.
People scream for it. But it's really funny that there's so many, how y'all doing? Let's drink some beer and kick some ass. And then for us, it's like sheetrock. And it's like, it's just a wholly different.
We begged for it.
That belonged to her too, but she uses her new boyfriends instead. You said you were sorry and you begged for her to wait.
You know, based on a true story, in Austin, an old singer-songwriter friend of mine who he was going through some tough times, and it's a lot of just actual things in there. You know, that feeling of, I was working in a law firm at the time, part-time, and going in there, and the place is just cleaned out, and something's going on, you know, kind of thing. I'd written a song called Woman, which is the very last song on Phil World, which is a similar type song. It was based on a friend of mine going through a divorce, but written like I was him, you know.
Yeah.
So I was kind of into exploring that kind of, you know, writing from someone else's perspective, or really digging into what somebody else had going on and applying it to my own life. But there's a lot of life stuff in there. You know, of course, empty rooms and stuff like that.
Well, empty rooms. There's a lyric in there that says, "It's a life of self-inflicted pain. I hope my children never know." And you laugh, but that sums up to me, from an outsider looking in, that is life as a musician. Because even when times are good, you're away from your family most of the time. Even when things are going great, you can't be at home on a Saturday. You're gone.
You can't
you're
be in two
town.
Places at once.
And
no, that's right.
You miss these pivotal moments, kids walking and things going on, but you're living your dream and you're doing what you're destined to do and out there cutting your teeth on the road. But no matter what happens in good or bad times, mm-hmm. you miss out on a lot of your family times and your friends, and people move on, and you miss those because everyone else hangs out on the weekend.
Yeah.
And you're gone.
Well, and it's like that in any part of life. It's something I've really grown to see, of course, as I continue to have children at an alarming rate. I have four now. It's kind of a joke. But just great kids. Of course, you love being home with them all.
Mm-hmm.
But you do have to force yourself to not force yourself, but make time. You have to say no to some gigs and mm-hmm. some ideas and projects. And, man, most of the guys that I'm friends with in this business who are performers – you know, some of them have kids, one or two, and a vast majority of them have no kids or are not married, and so
or don't know their kids,
or don't know if they do have.
Yeah.
Some. But it is a common denominator in this that if you can devote that kind of time to it, some of these guys can devote. And I play every night of the week. I do every radio show, every press interview, every you know, I go schmooze and hobnob with people, and there's guys that are great at that and built great careers at it. I've always felt that I have never put that kind of effort into my career on that front, simply because I just said, man, I got to be home for a little while, and I wanted to be home. So mm-hmm. I've always done what I've wanted, but it's hard to have to accept those sorts of things that inevitably, you know, that's going to show up somewhere. If you just don't go out and practice for 10 hours a day like Tiger Woods and hit balls, you say, man, I'm just going to go out for 5 hours.
Yeah.
You know, you might be able to make the cut and make a living playing golf, but if you can't really sit there and kick yourself and go, man, how come I'm not winning the U.S. Open? You're kind of like, man, you're not playing golf all day long every single day and not doing anything else. So it's a tough balancing act and it's mm-hmm. like that in life. You know, your kids, your work, and all that. It's a very, very tough balancing act, and I wouldn't change it for the world, but there are sometimes when you see a guy being really successful, if he has none of that going on, I mean, all that guy does, he sleeps till 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
You know, he wakes up, cracks a beer, and just works on his career.
That's
all he does. And you know what? Yeah. And it's paid off for him. Look at his whatever he's got going on.
A professional drinker, a professional partier.
Yeah, he just stays out all night. He just, you know, meets people and flies around and he's the big thing. And, you know, the older I get and the longer I've done it, the less attention I've quit reading music magazines and stuff. Of course, when I started out, I was very fascinated with it, but I really don't read much about anybody. It's I don't read the local papers or anything like that. Because it does get discouraging, and somewhere I just kind of quit reading them. And you do your own thing, and you try to balance it the best you can. And the better you do that, the better you're going to do overall. But Suburban Legends, I think, really was a first step into kind of examining those new realities of life. You know, having kids and a wife, and trying to make it all work.
It's real deep. You go back and get it if you don't have it, if you never heard it. It's totally worth. It's one of those albums you can listen to over and over again, and really dive into some of the songs and get deeper with them, and start to go past just the hooks and what's going on, and look deeper into it. And one thing that you didn't touch that I definitely yeah. wanted to hear you say, but and your choice or not, but your
story for another time.
Your musician buddy that you wrote Bruising Sheetrock about.
Uh-huh.
I remember hearing the story, and I'd been a fan and a friend for a while, and you'd never shared the story ever. Mm-hmm. Jordan Powell actually told me the story one night, because I used to always tell him this is my favorite.
He
walked me through it all, and I was just blown away, and you never talked about it. And so I remember one time you told, I mean maybe once in our 10 years of being friends, you told the story all the way through. And I just have this visual picture of a guy sitting in his home. Everything's gone. Up and down the hall is just holes in the sheetrock where he's punched holes in them. And he's just got the ice pack on his hand. And there's nothing left but a bed in his room. And I guess a stereo was on the ground.
Yeah, right.
And there was one record playing over and over and over again on that stereo. Yeah. You remember that?
Yeah.
What record?
Yeah. The Band.
The Band.
Yeah.
And I have a newfound love at that time. For the Band.
I went
and bought the Band Greatest Hits, and I would listen to it. And I remember
was the record of choice.
Yeah, I remember you saying y'all just sat there and talked about life and what was going on, and this the depression of the moment, and the holes in the sheetrock everywhere, and just the Band playing in the background over and over and over again, and just how that just etched in my mind. I can't get that out. Like I just when I hear that song, man, I just see that whole thing unfold. It's just a painted picture that stays there.
Well, I think I did tell Jordan kind of where it was based on. I'm always very hesitant to ever really explain. I like talking about funny things that happen around songs or albums and stuff like that. But I kind of subscribe to the view that if you do your job right as a songwriter and a storyteller, that it's all in the song, and anything somebody takes away from it by me explaining exactly what it means or where it came from, takes away from their experience a little bit.
Yeah.
And maybe that's completely not true, but I kind of like to, as well as I can, speak through the songs and let people just hold their own, idea of what it is, or something like that.
I don't think Raul knew the story behind
the intricacies. I
think we need. Yeah, we need.
Maybe he has some better perspective.
Yeah,
Raul Hernandez. Well,
jerk.
He's driven me to here. He's driven me to this spot. Well, that is the vault. The little Suburban Legends talk. Some of these albums we will revisit time and again. You haven't heard the last of these analysis on some old recordings and stuff like that. You can get them all. P2Tunes.com. They're $4 a piece. Instant download, of course, at iTunes as well. Go to www.philpritchett.com. Book the Band. Like Blake Walker. Maybe play a keg part in your backyard.
Oh, yeah.
We still do it, man. Yeah. We still do it. Roll into town.
You played my wedding, man.
Oh, we played the Blake Walker wedding as well.
I had to fight for that one, dude. I love you, Megan. We had to fight for that one, yeah.
Fight for the wedding. But we were there. Phil Pritchett and the full band played Blake Walker. Blake and the beautiful Megan played their wedding.
Rocked it out.
So much fun. And so we love the private party. Call us. Email me. Book us for a show. We'd love it. Also, come see the studio, record here. I don't care if you're like a serious musician or if you're just some guy in a fun band and wants to record. That's what we do here. The number's 817-733-5256. Everything's at phil@philpritchett.com. Email us if you want to hear something on the podcast. Thanks for listening. Blake Walker, thanks for being here.
Thanks again.
Walker, Texas Road Manager. We will see y'all again. Stay tuned. We'll see y'all next week. Take care out there.
Bye-bye.